This is Intelligence Matters, sponsored by Flare, a leader in providing actionable cyber threat intelligence to companies and governments around the world.
General David Petraeus is a retired four-star general from the United States Army, where he served for 37 years. He concluded his time in uniform with six consecutive commands as a general officer. General Petraeus served as director of CIA, and today is a partner at global financial investment firm KKR and chairman of KKR Global Institute. General Petraeus, along with noted historian Andrew Roberts, have written a new book, Conflict: The Evolution of Warfare from 1945 to Ukraine. We'll be right back with General David Petraeus. But first, here's my colleague, Michael Morrell, with a message about Flare.
The lines between geopolitical risk and cyber risk are blurring. Flare is a next-generation, continuous threat exposure management SaaS platform that equips corporate information security teams with world-class collection and continuous monitoring across dark web cybercrime forums, markets, Telegram channels, and sources of geopolitical risk. Flare sets up in 30 minutes, creates actionable intelligence from hour one, and is used by governments, security teams, and threat intelligence teams around the world. You can try Flare's free trial at their website, flare.io. That's flare.io.
Welcome back. General Petraeus, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you for your distinguished 38 and a half years of service to the nation. As I mentioned at the top of the podcast, you and Andrew Roberts have a new book out, Conflict: The Evolution of Warfare from 1945 to Ukraine. Before we dive into the book, let's spend a minute or two on the opening. You talk about the four major tasks of strategic leadership. What are they?
First, the strategic leader, and this is the civilian at the very, very top, who, as you and I, when we served together, in fact, at the Great Place, will recall, have to sketch out the policy objectives, make the really fundamental decisions. And then in the case of conflict, it's the theater commander, the battlefield commander, who has to understand the nature of the conflict, understand the enemy forces, friendly geographic terrain, human terrain, neighborhood, all of these other issues, and get the big ideas right, craft the right strategy. So task number one, which is far and away the most important, is to get the big ideas right. Then the strategic leader has to communicate the big ideas effectively through the breadth and depth of the organization and to all others who have a stake in the outcome of the conflict. Task three is to oversee the implementation of the big ideas, what we normally think of as leadership, the example, the energy, the inspiration, how the leader spends his or her time. That's critical because that's how you drive the implementation of the campaign plan. Should include going out and seeing it for yourself multiple times a week, etc. It's the metrics, and they need to be the right metric to ensure whether you are making progress or falling back. They have to be rigorous. They have to be honest. It's attracting great people and keeping and developing them. It's allowing those not measuring up to move on to something else. And then a fourth task that's sometimes overlooked, which is formally, so with events on your battle rhythm, on your calendar, to drive action, formally to sit down and determine how the big ideas need to be refined, adapted, so that they can be communicated, implemented, and you do it again and again and again. That is far and away the biggest, the most important factor, the component that determines success or failure in conflict. I would also submit, having been in the private sector for 10 and a half years now, it's also what determines success in the business world, the nonprofit world, the world of academia, whatever it is. Strategic leadership is absolutely critical. All other leaders do perform these four tasks, but they do it within the confines, the intent, the decisions of the strategic leader who has made the fundamental choices about the big ideas that are going to galvanize, that are going to guide this particular endeavor.
So let's talk a little bit about the book. What was the impetus for conflict, and how did your unique experiences as a military leader and scholar shape your particular approach?
Well, what galvanized it was Andrew Roberts calling me up after the Russians invaded Ukraine and suggesting that there should be a book that provides the military history context for that particular war, starting with at 1945 and going through Ukraine at that point, and then also talking about the future of war. I had been looking for an opportunity to write about the two wars that I was privileged to command, Iraq and Afghanistan, and also to revisit Vietnam, which was the subject of my PhD dissertation. So I was delighted to have the opportunity to do this with one of the world's greatest historians and biographers, noting that this is his 20th book, but the first which he ever had a co-author. As you'll recall from our time together, I loved writing with others as well. I enjoyed having speechwriters. I enjoyed being a speechwriter when I was in uniform for several different individuals, including the NATO Supreme Allied Commander of Europe. And so this is an opportunity to do that with one of the masters of the profession and someone who also is just absolutely delightful, a quintessential Brit, great sense of humor, incredible encyclopedic recall of wonderful, often humorous episodes in the past. And so we then, we used his agent, went to publishers, HarperCollins won the bidding. They then asked us how we intended to go about writing the book. And Andrew quickly said, well, General Petraeus will write about the countries that he invaded, plus Vietnam. and he said, I'll fill in the rest. So, and we had a very enjoyable collaboration. We wrote back and forth. Each of us would edit very heavily what the other did. And the editor very sensibly, I think, when it came to Iraq and Afghanistan, which we originally submitted, and I led that effort on those, submitted in the third person, which is the way history is typically written, of course. And the editor said, this just doesn't work. You know, it just doesn't make sense for you to say. And then General Petraeus went to meet with Prime Minister Maliki, and they discussed the following. He said, just do these two in the first person. That led to me also reading those two chapters for the audio version of the book as well. So it was really a wonderful experience. It was, you know, fairly intense because we produced it in roughly a year or so within all of the editing and all the rest of that to follow. And we've also had a delightful time on the book tour. And then somewhat, you know, very gratifyingly for a military history book to make the New York Times bestseller list is a very nice validation.
So let's get to some of the heart of today's discussion. In the early section of the book on the Korean War, you say that it changed the nature of warfare. How did it do that, and what are the lessons for today?
Well, it was the first major war of the nuclear age, with nuclear weapons, of course, having been used to bring the war in the Pacific to an end, but not having been used since then. But this is the first case in which that might have been possible. Indeed, General MacArthur, after miscalculating and going north to the Yalu, brought the Chinese into the war, something he predicted would not happen, and resulted in the U.S.-led coalition forces being pushed all the way down to the south of the peninsula again. Actually was talking about the use of nuclear weapons. He was essentially sacked at that point in time. General Ridgway replaced him. And ever since then, all wars that have taken place in the nuclear age have never seen the use of nuclear weapons. There's always been a limit on wars, if you will, ever since that first use of nuclear weapons at Nagasaki and Hiroshima. So in that sense, quite a path-breaking war. Clearly, that's not a given. The world needs to continue to work very diligently and hard to ensure that nuclear weapons are not used. There's a threshold there that, if crossed, could be catastrophic for the world. And that first test case, again, the leadership stepped back and was not willing to consider the use of nuclear weapons for fear of where it might lead. So very much a path-breaking war in that regard, and every war since then, including those that have had nuclear-capable countries on one side or the other, have not used those weapons. They've always kept below that particular threshold.
You mentioned Vietnam at the beginning here. On the chapter on Vietnam, You start with a historical quote, which says in part, "The first, the supreme, the most far-reaching act of judgment that the statesman and commander have to make is to establish the kind of war on which they are embarking, neither mistaking it for nor trying to make it into something that is alien to its nature." Why do you believe this is applicable to the conflict in Vietnam?
Because we failed to do that, at least until 1968. So this is 13 years before we truly got the big ideas right, following on the French, who also didn't get the big ideas right. Dien Bien Phu, obviously, was a catastrophe. The French were frustrated that the communist Vietnamese, led by Ho Chi Minh, would not come to battle, that they were elusive. They were fighting as guerrillas, as insurgents. And so they decided they would create a huge base well out into the rural area. And yes, it was surrounded by hills, but they dismissed the idea that the Vietnamese could get artillery up onto those hills and take advantage of that geographic position. They did. And ultimately, yes, the French were able to bring the Viet Minh to battle, but they lost eventually and had to surrender. Their forces became prisoners of war. There was eventually a convention, peace agreement reached at Geneva, which resulted in the French withdrawal from Indochina and North and South Vietnam being partitioned with a demilitarized zone in between. The U.S. entered. The South Vietnamese asked for help with providing security in the hamlets and villages and districts, which is where the problems were, against essentially, again, guerrillas, communist political cadre, what would become known as the Viet Cong. And the U.S. said, no, we're fresh from the war in Korea and World War II. What you need is a force structure that has big units and will help you make 9 entire army divisions, each of those 10 to 15,000 soldiers, the same structure as we have, of course. And those were not that useful for providing security for the people, which should be the number one task in that kind of conflict. So we really did not seem to understand the nature of the conflict. And we certainly didn't craft the right strategy for it, at least until General Abrams took command in late 1968, by which time domestic public support in the U.S. had begun to erode very alarmingly. We should have had from the beginning what is best termed a comprehensive civil military counterinsurgency campaign, supporting the Vietnamese as they are doing that, rather than bringing in large American units, taking over the war, making it into a big war, choosing a metric that was the wrong metric, enemy body count. We could not win a war of attrition against the communist Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese Army, and the Viet Cong. And in fact, search and destroy missions, as the concept was described, turned out often to alienate the very people that we should have been securing with fairly indiscriminate use of air power, artillery, harassing and interdicting fires, as they were termed, unobserved use of artillery, mad minutes where everyone in the defensive perimeter just opens fire into the wood line around it. This kind of thing often created more bad guys than it took off the streets by their conduct. So, in many, many respects, we just did not get the strategy right. And it was because we did not observe that dictum from Clausewitz that you quoted about the supreme, the most important task of a commander is to understand the nature of the war and not try to make it something that we'd like to fight. We brought in units that were not trained, equipped, nor inclined really even to fight the war that mattered most, at least for the first decade or so of that war. Certainly at a certain point in time, the North Vietnamese would develop conventional force capabilities. But the initial approach for quite some period should have been to focus on security of the population, as we did, by the way, during the surge in Iraq. Live with the people. Ironically, the Marines got it right. They had an approach called CAP, in which the Marines did live with the villagers, with the hamlets in the districts. It constructed a civil military approach, really understood The people they were trying to help and to secure did so with the local security forces at the district and province level and had quite successful outcomes. And the metrics established that. And those metrics were much more appropriate for that war than was the metric of enemy body count, which, by the way, also then became subject to essentially inflation, dishonest reporting, the pressure for this, as with many of the other metrics. There are a number of other shortcomings in that war, individual rotation rather than unit rotation, short service draftees, et cetera, et cetera. But the single biggest deficiency was the lack of the right strategy, misunderstanding of the nature of the war, and therefore the wrong big ideas. And so again, to come back to this strategic leadership model, it doesn't matter how impressive the strategic leader's skills are in communication, example, inspiration, all the rest of this, if you don't get the big ideas right up front. So the real essence, the critical component in a strategic leader is this strategic judgment. And there are a number of cases in the book, of course, in which that was lacking, and a number of cases, in fact, where it was also very impressive.
Hey, you know what I found interesting about that chapter is that some of the things in that in there do echo into today.
Very much so, sure. And we saw it in Iraq. And of course, ironically, although the Army in particular did enormous soul searching after the Vietnam War about policies on command tour length and, again, unit rotation rather than individual rotation, professionalization of the forces, importance of integrity and reporting and readiness and so on. We also consigned the study of irregular warfare, counterinsurgency, to the ash bin of history and essentially said, we don't want to do this again, so let's not be ready to do it. And of course, that would prove to be a challenge when we were actually conducting counterinsurgency campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan and didn't even have a counterinsurgency field manual in the Army until we published it in 2006, several years into each of those wars.
So we'll talk about Iraq and Afghanistan here in a minute, but I did want to ask you a question about one of the chapters in your book entitled The New World Disorder, the result of the end of the Cold War and of a bipolar world. Do you think we're still in a world of disorder today, or do you see the rise of China, which we'll also talk about in a few minutes, taking us back to a Cold War-like uneasy stability?
I'm a bit uneasy with the term Cold War, although undeniably there are certain aspects of the relationship between the U.S. and the West, our allies and partners, and China. It's the most important relationship in the world. As our National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, has described it, it is best characterized as fierce competition. Needless to say, what the militaries and governments in general need to do is ensure that fierce competition doesn't turn into actual confrontation. But there are also elements of the relationship that are just completely different from the Cold War and make the analogy, in some cases, actually unhelpful rather than explanatory. And that, in particular, this is the aspect, the reality that China is our number three trading partner, and I believe we may be their number one, or certainly one of their top two. And of course, there was no relationship like that between the U.S. and NATO economically with the Soviet Union and even the Warsaw Pact. Our trade with the Soviet Union, of course, probably never exceeded $1 billion. It was mostly some excess wheat that we were happy to send over there. But in the case of China, we have enormous dependency on minerals that are processed in China. We learned protective equipment during the pandemic comes predominantly from China. An awful lot of the pharmaceutical components come from China. China is where the manufacture and assembly of iPhones takes place. So again, very, very enormous dependencies by the U.S. and other countries with China. Again, China is the largest trading partner for over 120 countries in the world. And until recently has been the largest source of growth for the world as well. But China is also dependent on us. It literally cannot feed its people or its livestock without what it imports from the United States. So again, the Cold War analogy has distinct limits in this regard. We should recognize that, even as, yes, there is a bit of an emergence of a bloc, if you will, around the U.S. And major Western countries and the relationship with China. And to a much lesser degree, there's a bit of a bloc around China with its partnership without limits with Russia, supposedly, although, as you know, there have been limits. And then, you know, some other relatively modest players such as Cambodia, et cetera. So again, I think it's very, one of the lessons of my dissertation, in fact, was that analogies, lessons of history need to be applied very carefully because they can obfuscate as well as illuminate.
So let's talk about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they certainly presented some unique challenges for U.S. and coalition forces. And you, of course, have deep, you know, on-the-ground knowledge of both conflicts. So maybe starting with Iraq, what were the biggest challenges you faced as commander of the multinational force?
Well, as the multinational force, of course, that's the final tour that I had on the ground as a four-star commander of all forces in Iraq in a U.S.-led multinational force. The big challenge was that the country was in a Sunni-Shia civil war. Other than that, everything was great. But, you know, as going in as a two-star division commander of the great 101st Airborne Division during the invasion, I quickly came to realize that we didn't have the kind of detailed, granular understanding of Iraq that would have been very, very helpful. Indeed, our post-conflict planning turned out to be very flawed. A number of the assumptions that we were provided were invalidated literally during the fight to Baghdad. And then we also took pursued some seriously bad big ideas. As you'll recall, and I don't remember where you were in those days, if you were at Langley or where at that time, but firing the Iraqi army without telling them what their future was and how we would enable them to provide for their family essentially created many hundreds of thousands of armed men with an incentive to oppose the new Iraq rather than to support it. And then we compounded that by firing the Ba'ath Party. Sure, you need to take out Saddam and his sons and these other evil people around them. But when you went all the way down to level four, they were essentially the bureaucrats, and again, probably 100,000 or more, that largely Western educated, quite secular, and we actually needed them to help run a country that we really didn't fully understand. And we did that without an agreed reconciliation process. So they were out for life at that moment in time. That's how they saw it. And again, their incentive was to oppose the new Iraq rather than to support it as well. So this violated very significant way a question that was always on the wall of my operations centers during the two-star, three-star, and then three, four-star combat tours, which asked, will this operation take more bad guys off the street than it creates by its conduct? If the answer to that is no, in other words, it will create more bad guys than it takes off the street, you're supposed to go back and examine how you can change the conduct of the operation so that you change the answer to the question. And if you can't get to yes, you're supposed to go sit under a tree until the thought passes. Well, these two actions violated that in enormous scale. And it took us many, many years, really, to recover from that. And in some respects, we never really did, because, of course, this created, in many cases, the future insurgents, in some cases, future extremists, and in other cases, future militia members. We did then sort things out during that two-star tour. 101st Airborne Division got an exception to the policy where we were allowed to conduct reconciliation, the only division with that authority in Iraq. It made a huge difference in Mosul and went very well until I left. And then the various Shia individuals in Baghdad, Dr. Shalabi most prominent among them, would not consider the decisions, would not support the decisions that we had made. So it undermined all that we'd done. And it took us many years until the surge, in fact, until we could do industrial strength reconciliation and bring people back into the fold, back into the fabric of society, who had been cast out by these various decisions. I was there as for a three-star tour to establish what became known as the Multinational Security Transition Command. This is the train and equip mission. It turned out to be a massive endeavor. We used to describe it as building the world's largest aircraft while it was in flight, while it was being designed, and while it was being shot at. This is the effort to resurrect all elements of the ministries of interior and defense, including the ministries themselves, all infrastructure, schools, training centers, doctrinal manuals, war colleges, staff colleges, academies, et cetera, et cetera. And then had that period of 15 and a half months in the States where we focused on developing a counterinsurgency field manual, distilling what it was we'd learned, overhauling every aspect of the road to deployment for our leaders, our organizations, the materiel, the training of them, et cetera. And then, you know, somewhat uniquely, if you will, in history, got to go back to Iraq as a four-star at a very perilous moment for the country. As you'll recall, there were over 53 civilians killed every 24 hours just in Baghdad and dying not of natural causes. And then to help bring that country out of a civil war, drive violence down by nearly 90%, give it a whole new opportunity, which it did very well to continue for another 3.5 years until our combat forces were withdrawn. The Iraqi security forces took their eye off the Islamic State, which had been destroyed during the surge. And a couple of years later, you have a caliphate and we have to go back in. But again, the challenges largely were about, at the outset, really an inability to fully understand a country that we now owned in large measure. You break it, you own it, in the famous words of Secretary of State Powell. And then taking actions that actually undermined our ability to actually administer that country, it certainly made it much, much more difficult. There's another aspect of it that I always puzzled about, and that I think I came to grips with while writing this chapter, which is why we didn't establish an embassy right away on the ground and use existing organizations. It seems to me one of the lessons of the first year and a half in Iraq is to always use existing organizations rather than one-offs. The Coalition Provisional Authority had some very talented, dedicated, committed people, but often the rank and file, the bulk of them, were rotating every 3 months. It was a non-standard organization, and it had to create from scratch all the elements that it was using, the contracting office, the engineering, the reconstruction, all of these. And we should have just established an embassy at the beginning. I think the only explanation is that those in the Pentagon wanted to continue to largely run the war rather than share it with the Department of State, which would have been the case clearly if there was an embassy. But again, you might have an understanding of that too, based on where you were at the time.
Yeah, I remember that time particularly well.
The biggest takeaway, I think, from the surge in Iraq in particular was, again, the importance of getting the big ideas right, because the surge of forces was hugely important in enabling us to implement the new strategy rapidly, because as you'll recall, we faced a hearing 6 months into the effort where we really had to have progress to report or we could have lost the residual support in the Senate, having already largely lost the House of Representatives. So that was very important. But what really mattered was, again, the change in strategy. And it was literally 180 degrees different from what we'd been doing before. We had been handing off security responsibilities to the Iraqi security forces and pulling our forces out of the neighborhoods, out of the communities, consolidating on big bases, and then preparing to go home. And that strategy was valid until about 10 months before the start of the surge in February 2006, when there was a catastrophically bad event, a Sunni extremist al-Qaeda bombing of a sacred Shia shrine in a Sunni area that set off a cycle of sectarian violence, Sunni versus Shia, that escalated so dramatically and had the country in a civil war in many areas of the country by the time the surge was launched. So we determined that we had to go back into the neighborhoods in order to secure the people, which was job one. That had to be the focus. 77 additional locations just in the greater Baghdad area alone, most of which we had to fight to establish. We had to take back control from the Iraqi security forces. We had to reconcile with as many of the rank and file of the insurgents and the Shia militia as we could, even as we intensified the pursuit of the irreconcilable. We had an intelligence effort, as you'll recall, to determine who is irreconcilable and who is reconcilable. And if you were irreconcilable, then we had to capture or kill those individuals. And that approach, by and large, with an even greater integration of civil and military, greater joining up in coordination, a campaign plan that was signed by both the ambassador and me, for example, that was what enabled us to pull the country out of a civil war, to reverse the increase in violence at the time, to drive it down, as I noted, by over 85, nearly 90%, and to give the country a whole new opportunity. So again, it comes back to strategic leadership. It starts with understanding the nature of the conflict and the situation on the ground, and then crafting the right strategy, getting the big ideas right, communicating them, overseeing their implementation, and then determining how you need to refine them as the context evolves so that you can do it again and again and again.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more of our discussion with General David Petraeus.
Beacon Global Strategies is the premier national security advisory firm. Beacon works side by side with leading companies to help them understand national security policy, geopolitical risk, global technology policy, and federal procurement trends. Beacon's insight gives business leaders the decision advantage. Founded in 2013, Beacon develops and supports the execution of bespoke strategies to mitigate business risk, drive growth, and navigate a complex geopolitical environment. With a bipartisan team and decades of experience, Beacon provides a global perspective to help clients tackle their toughest challenges.
Pivoting to Afghanistan, with those thoughts in mind, what were the big lessons there and the challenges that you faced when you were in Afghanistan?
Well, as you'll recall, there was a brilliant campaign at the outset in Afghanistan that toppled the Taliban, essentially a handful of special forces on horse with CIA operations officers with footlockers full of money and warlords as partners that would use their forces to force the Taliban to mass and then would clobber them with air power, shatter them. This was all necessary, of course, because the Taliban refused to extradite the leadership of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which, of course, had planned the 9/11 attacks in a sanctuary in eastern Afghanistan and conducted the initial training of the attackers there as well. That campaign was extraordinary. We toppled the Taliban very quickly, much more rapidly than anyone expected. Did it without having to introduce major conventional forces at that time, and eliminated that sanctuary, although, of course, Osama bin Laden and many of his extremist terrorists did get away to Pakistan. We then, however, very quickly focused on Iraq, and Iraq became the main effort. It was where the resources went. As Admiral Mullen, great chairman of the Joint Chiefs, almost throughout all of my four-star commands, used to say, in Iraq, we do what we must. In Afghanistan, we do what we can. And what we can was never sufficient. So if you look at the sweep of time in Afghanistan, the bottom line is that we didn't even get the inputs right in Afghanistan after that brilliant initial campaign for 9 years. General McChrystal, my predecessor there, indeed I was the central command commander when he was the commander on the ground, did get the strategy right, that of a comprehensive civil-military counterinsurgency campaign, got the organizational architecture very much headed in the right direction. We did some additional work with that when I took command from him. But we didn't get the right level of resources, forces on the ground, diplomats, spies, development workers, rule of law experts, all the other individuals with expertise that was required until, again, 9 years from the very beginning, late 2010. And we only kept it right for about 6 or 7 months before we began a drawdown that wasn't really based on conditions. It was based more on calculations in Washington. And a drawdown that, of course, was the date of which was announced in the speech that announced the buildup of forces, which therefore tells the enemy with whom you're in a contest of wills that we are going to start drawing down on a date certain. So again, lots of missed opportunities during that nine-year period, during which the level of violence in Afghanistan was very, very low. You know, a lot of folks will say, gosh, we never should have gone down the road of nation building at all. Anyway, we should have just toppled the Taliban and left. Well, you know, we broke it. We owned it. And if you don't do nation building, if you don't help train host nation security forces and help develop institutions that can take over the tasks that our soldiers and diplomats and spies are performing, you can't leave without it all collapsing. Now, tragically, it did anyway. Although my view was that the final number that we had on the ground was very sustainable. 3,500 troops, $25 billion a year, hadn't lost a soldier in combat for 18 months. We could have easily sustained that just the way we've sustained very large deployments of forces in places like Korea, Japan, Europe, and elsewhere over the years. And I did feel, I feared that what would happen if we did pull out would be something we would regret, and I certainly hope we do, because what we left behind once the Taliban toppled that regime, and whose leadership turned out to be quite disappointing, needless to say, is a country in which millions of people voted with their feet and fled to Pakistan. Now they're being pushed back into Afghanistan, as you know. Over 50% of the country is very malnourished. The economy has collapsed. The Taliban has reimposed a very ultra-conservative 8th century interpretation of Islam, which denies 50% of the population, the females, any real meaningful opportunity to contribute to the economy or even to do much outside the home without a male escort. So again, it's quite tragic. And of course, Al-Qaeda's senior leadership was found within a few blocks of the presidential palace not long after the Taliban took over.
So, General Petraeus, let's turn to today and two conflicts, of course. The first one is Russia-Ukraine. And maybe I can ask, you know, what are the factors that you see that are shaping that conflict and maybe some possible scenarios, you know, either for resolution or escalation? We see this very slow slog by the Russians. Where do you think things are going?
I think it depends. It depends on a number of factors. One is continued U.S. support, which I strongly believe should continue. I believe this is about as right versus wrong as it gets. Invasion of a neighbor that was unprovoked and has been very brutal, ordered by a dictator, a kleptocrat leader of Russia, who has a grievance-filled revisionist and revanchist view of history that denies Ukraine a right to exist and Ukrainians to exist as a separate people. So we should be helping there. We should also obviously help in Israel and Taiwan and southern border, you name it. Let's get on with that, U.S. Congress. It depends on continued European support. That appears to be quite solid. There are some individual countries that are cause for concern, to be sure, but the major countries, Germany and the others, are quite steadfast in this regard. And Europe has actually now pledged more in security assistance than has the U.S., and the U.S. has provided a very substantial amount, over $44 billion over the course of the war as it approaches the end of its second year. It depends on Ukraine being able to generate additional forces. It depends on Russia generating additional forces, noting that the Russian population is over three times that of Ukraine's, and its economy is even larger relative to Ukraine than that. But Russia has not mobilized. The burden is falling largely on small villages and towns and rural areas rather than on those in Moscow and St. Petersburg. And support for the war, according to the latest polls that are relatively reliable in Russia, has really plunged in recent months, with many Russians wanting to resolve this and not to continue to fight. Putin, on the other hand, I think is still convinced that he can outsuffer the Ukrainians, the Europeans, and the Americans. There are questions raised by, of course, the challenges that we have on Capitol Hill, and also by the prospects of who might be elected in November of next year. So there's a number of different features here. The commander-in-chief of the Ukrainian forces, General Zeluzhny, with whom I met for over 2 hours when I was there about 6 weeks ago, has recently described in an essay in The Economist the situation as a stalemate, but identified the various capabilities that Ukraine needs to break that stalemate. Some of these they can develop themselves. They have very good engineering, IT, and other skills. Others they'll need to get from us and the other countries supporting Ukraine. So again, all of these different factors enter into this. There's the possibility of Ukrainian forces being able to pressure the Russians so substantially that the Russians might crack and crumble. Keep in mind, morale in war is something that we highlight repeatedly in the book. The Ukrainians know what they're fighting for. It's their survival. It's their war of independence. It's the people they can see over their shoulder when they look around. The Russians aren't quite as certain about that. Indeed, when the Russian soldiers look around, what they see are abusive commanders, not particularly great logistical support, and Ukrainians in the areas occupied by Russia who hate them. So again, all of these, when you put them together, could there be a negotiated resolution? It doesn't appear right now. Neither side is willing to negotiate. Each side thinks that it can prevail. The Ukrainians are determined to liberate all of their territory. They won't even discuss the possibility of negotiation. But who knows what could happen at some point down the road as various opportunities for Ukraine are held out, EU membership, NATO membership, some kind of Marshall-like reconstruction plan, access to the $300 billion in foreign reserves that are in Western countries, Russian foreign reserves, and also the increasing pressure of sanctions and export controls on Russia and pressure on those who are evading those at this point in time. So lots of dynamics there. Again, as a former head of analysis and so forth, you would appreciate that there's no simple answer to this. Rather, there are many different factors or elements that will come together in a multilateral equation and determine the answer at the end of the day.
So, General, now turning to another very complex situation in a little bit of time we have left, I'd love to get your take on Israel, Gaza, especially, you know, from your perspective on counterinsurgency operations. You know, this seems like an exceedingly difficult situation. What do you think?
Andrew Roberts and I looked at Gaza in considerable detail. It happened just as the book was published. And our assessment is that this is the most difficult urban situation context, fiendishly difficult, of every such similar context since 1945. Maybe Mariupol or some others have some similarity, but there's all differences. And the challenges here for the Israeli Defense Forces are enormous. You have very densely populated high rises, not just small dwellings. You have to clear every floor, room, cellar, tunnel, building, and then you have to hold it. You raised a very good point, which is counterinsurgency. I think that's the approach that should be taken, because it reminds in this case, the IDF, that you should be concerned not just about clearing areas, not just about destroying Hamas, which is the overriding objective. That's the biggest of the big ideas, together with dismantling the political wing of Hamas. But you also have to hold the area so that the enemy can't re-infiltrate. And you need to be concerned about the population, about the people. When we did Ramadi, Fallujah, Bakuba, all these other major urban operations in Iraq during the surge, we always laid out for the people the prospect for a better future, that we are going to separate you from Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the Sunni insurgents, Shia militia, and we're going to make your life much better. And so you should help us to do that, or at least don't impede us. And I think that's an important component. That's a big idea that I think the more that's described would be helpful. And then, of course, there's a challenge to ensure that Hamas cannot reconstitute. We learned the hard way that if the forces that were left behind in Iraq, the Iraqi security forces, if they take their eye off the Islamic State, as they did after our combat forces left, they can reconstitute. And, of course, a couple of years later, you had the first ever Islamist extremist caliphate in northern Iraq and northeastern Syria, and we had to go in and help the partner forces in each of those areas to eliminate that caliphate and to destroy the Islamic State. Keep in mind, in my view, Hamas is akin to the Islamic State in the sense that they are extremists. They are terrorists, a terrorist army. They have to be, they're irreconcilable. They do have to be destroyed. And yes, there's a Palestinian nationalist component to this that makes it different, if you will, from the Islamic State. But by and large, that analogy is not completely misplaced. But you have to then ensure that they cannot reconstitute. So how is that going to be done? There needs to be a big idea for that. And frankly, there has to be a big idea about what life will be like for the people after Hamas and Islamic Jihad and the political wing of Hamas have all been dismantled, destroyed. And who is going to administer Gaza if you take down the existing government? Who's going to oversee the effort to provide humanitarian assistance? Yeah, the UN can do some of that, but they can't oversee the government that is going to have to be established to restore basic services, oversee reconstruction, get people back into homes, all the myriad details required given the enormous displacement of the civilian population from the north to the south, and now presumably the necessity of operations in the south as well, given that the leader of Hamas inside Gaza appears to have gone to the south, as have a number of others. So I think all of these additional components, additional big ideas are needed. Yes, I think it would be great to have a Palestinian competent, capable, and trustworthy government for Hamas. I don't see it existing anywhere. It doesn't even exist in the West Bank, frankly. By the way, there should be a vision, I think, at the same time, this horrific, barbaric, unspeakable attack by Hamas that killed 1,200 Israelis and others. It should be a catalyst also to discuss the future of the Palestinians in the West Bank and how to make sure that, again, if you can't get to a two-state solution, at least don't create additional challenges for an eventual two-state solution. Build up the institutions and the economy that might make that possible down the road when the leadership situation is different there and also different in Jerusalem. So all of these different elements are present. And again, I appreciate that you mentioned, if you think of a counterinsurgency approach rather than just a conventional military campaign, you probably will have a better outcome in this case. And it will prompt you to provide the additional big ideas here, which, by the way, the Israelis are working on. I have discuss this with various interlocutors. They're keenly aware of the necessity of identifying who's going to govern. They're just understandably reluctant to say that it's going to be them, especially because the U.S. has cautioned them against that, and they don't want to reoccupy Gaza. They left for a reason in 2005, but it may be that there is no other alternative.
Thanks, General Petraeus. You know, it seems that you know, each succeeding conflict is more complicated than the previous.
That's true, yeah. And of course, the future of conflict is going to be even more diabolically complicated because you will see the advent of massive numbers of unmanned systems that increasingly will not even be remotely piloted. They'll be algorithmically piloted, enabled by AI and machine learning and all the rest of that, and in enormous numbers to overwhelm defenses. And you'll have, again, this offense defense. And so, as we write in the book, Ukraine has some signposts to the future of war, especially as each side has developed more cutting-edge unmanned aerial systems and maritime systems and some land systems. But what we would see in the future, if there was ever war between the world's two superpowers, God forbid, because we would need to deter that. And the way you do is by ensuring that the capabilities you have are seen as formidable by a potential adversary, and your willingness to use them is not in question. But that future is going to be very, very different from the force structure that we have today.
General Petraeus, it's been a fascinating discussion and a walk through, what, maybe seven decades of conflict. Thank you for your insights, and thanks for being on Intelligence Matters.
It is great to be with you again, Andy, and it's been great to be on Intelligence Matters in the past. And to do it again. Thank you.
That was General David Petraeus. I'm Andy McCreadis. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is produced by Steve Dorsey with assistance from Ashley Berry and Sophia Rubin. Intelligence Matters is a production of Beacon Global Strategies.